Glenn, how are you?
Hi, Josh. I'm fine. How you doing?
Good. We've been on a lot before and a lot together before, but maybe we should
introduce ourselves. It's been a long time since we've been on together also.
Yeah.
I'm Glenn Lowry. I teach economics and social sciences at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island.
Josh Cohen. I teach political science, philosophy, and law at Stanford University, and I am editor of Boston Review. New issue printed on Tuesday.
Congratulations. See, you have this cycle in your life where there's always a new issue. So
that's right. Yeah, there are, you know, it's not like the academic cycle. There's actually something to get done and there are deadlines and that kind of thing. It's good.
Yeah, I know. I've been sitting here for years without doing a whole lot, I sometimes feel.
Right.
Although hopefully someone will rush in and say, oh, no, Glenn, that's not true.
So
what's up?
Yeah, so you know we have talked pretty often over the past 2 years on blogging heads, and one thing that I thought we might start off with, I suppose maybe it's a little bit self-indulgent, but I think it might be worth doing.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. you know, nobody really holds us accountable for anything that we say here. It's probably inconsequential, so it doesn't matter.
Tell me you're not going to suggest that we hold ourselves accountable.
But we should hold ourselves accountable.
Oh, no.
we start off by reflecting a little bit on a couple of the things, two or three things, that we've said over here for the past year or two and that we've been wrong about. And I have a few favorite candidates for myself that I...
I've got some candidates for you too, Josh, as I recall some of our arguments. But no, I'll let you go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, the first one, and not one to that I want to dwell on, is that I was... 6 months ago, very pessimistic about anything happening on healthcare, and whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, I now think that was an excess of pessimism. I mean, but I don't want to dwell on that because maybe I'll unfortunately be right about that, and there won't be any serious reform. But there are two other things.
I just want to understand what you're saying about healthcare. Yeah. It's not that you thought the plan was not a good idea, and that's what you were pessimistic about.
Right.
It's that you thought it might not get through. And
I thought that there wouldn't be. I thought it would be like a replay of 1993, 1994, and a series of other episodes over the course of the 20th century where there were big efforts. Healthcare is all.
Can I object to that narrative? I know you've got a list, but let me just, healthcare, and these are things that you were wrong about, okay? So the thing I'm objecting to in the narrative is we've been trying since Teddy Roosevelt. Nobody's got it done. It just sounds like it's too much of a setup for Barack Obama to be FDR by getting something done no matter what it is, and it really doesn't matter what it is, and I think it actually matters a great deal what it is, and that's the thing that that we should be arguing about, not about whether or not something gets done, about exactly what's getting done. So that, there's something in the American political psyche that is this kind of pathology that won't let us get health care done. We tried, we failed, now we're going to get it done. And I don't know, is that right? I mean, is that obviously right? So let me put it this way.
Yeah.
If the Americans are immune to the welfare state, where was the political argument about our collective obligations to each other that got ratified in an election so that now we have a different, let's say, more Northern European attitude about the welfare state than we had before? We never had that argument.
No, we didn't.
So whatever was in the way of health care is still in the way or is not in the way and never was in the way, or if you follow my logic.
Yeah. So there have been a series of efforts at reform. They have all lost. There is at least one thing that Obama has arguably done right on healthcare reform that the Clintons didn't do right in 1993-94, which is that he said, "Here are some parameters, but where the White House is not going to write the legislation. Congress is going to have to do its work." I think that was understandable, but nevertheless, with 2020 hindsight, a serious strategic mistake by the Clinton people. There is also the fact that this problem has been hanging around for a long time. You know, there's whether it's 30 million people or 45 million people who are uninsured, costs keep going up. It is there is big political support for some kind of reform. So I agree with you that It matters hugely whether the reform is a good reform or a bad reform, and I'm not sure that that the reform that comes out will be a really good reform. Although I think it's probably going to be better better than the status quo, and better than the legislation looked like it was going to be 3 or 4 months ago. But you know, it remains to be seen. There's a lot of damage that can be done between now and the time that something gets passed. But my skepticism was really just about whether or not there was going to be any big healthcare reform passed at all. And in particular, you know, though the current numbers on, I think, on the Senate Finance Committee bill are that by a decade down the road, you're going to get 25 million people with insurance who would not otherwise be covered. There are still going to be a pretty large number of people who are uninsured. But I was predicting that you weren't going to get anything so substantial as that. I think another thing that I think I was I think I have a better sense about the source of the mistake, and it's more disturbing to me is. So when we had the surge in Iraq in 2007, there were lots of people, including people who were very close to the ground, who said, "This is ridiculous. It's not going to do any good, all it's going to do." And I think and then people like me who are not very close to the ground, but reading different sources, and there are some you believe and some you don't believe. You know, I believe the ones that said that this was not going to do any good because basically it was ideological. Those were people who had correctly, I think, opposed the war going in, as I had. And they were then saying, well, surge isn't going to do any good. So I opted for that view. And I think in a complicated way, in an interestingly complicated way, I think that that view was mistaken. When I say interestingly complicated, I mean, I think why the surge worked to the extent that it did is a pretty tough issue to diagnose, and I don't think it was just the surge. So there was just a piece on McChrystal in the Times on Sunday, and there was a British guy who's quoted in the article as saying what seems pretty plausible, which is that if they had tried the surge in 2004, it would have been a disaster. The difference between 2004 and 2007, well, it was really several-fold. First of all, you had more of a functioning government in Iraq. But also, basically, the Sunnis had been beaten. You know, there had been a big civil war in Iraq, and I think there was a general sense in the Shia community by 2007 that there was not going to be a reemergence of Sunnis. And so the civil, and to that extent, there had been a civil war, and the civil war was sort of, you know, was sort of winding down with a clear winner and a clear loser. And then what happened was that once the Sunnis were defeated, then there started being a lot of internecine fighting among the Shias. And, you know, there were, you know, accusations that the Mahdi army was turning into a bunch of gangs. And so the surge then, you know, was inserted in a situation where the likelihood of success was greater. But, you know, I think the effects on the ground since late 2007 and into 2008 to now, or the circumstances there are much, much better. I don't want to exaggerate the extent to which this owes to the surge, but you know, I think people who I was believing and things that I was saying were much more skeptical than was appropriate.
How is somebody like you, with due respect, supposed to have any clue about whether or not the surge is going to work?
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, you don't have the ability, I think, the expertise, the experience, the savvy, to be able to assess that. So ultimately, what we're talking about here is how we use, you know, specialized and expert knowledge that comes from a variety of sources of a variety of credibility and ideological coloration and formulate opinion. But you know, I mean, you can be forgiven for having been wrong about it. I think what you might not be forgiven for is not having been open-minded about it. That's really what you're saying.
That's the very fair, that's exactly the distinction that I think is the right one to draw here. You're absolutely right that, you know, you know, we have these conversations, and, you know, Blair on Blogging Heads, but, in, you know, in life more generally, we have conversations about political issues. We're not experts on them. We draw on sources. And there was a disagreement in 2007 about whether or not the surge was going to do any good or not. There were people who went as far, and this was something that I think we talked about at the time, where move on.
Josh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I have to interrupt.
Yeah.
But my dog is going crazy here, no kidding.
Yeah.
And I'm
going
to have to take him outside, okay?
Okay.
So can we just stop? And if you can just hang on the phone, and I'll be right back again.
Yes.
All right. We're back in business.
Back in business. Yeah. I think you're right that there's a big distinct, there's a situation that we're typically in, as, you know, there are lots of stuff that we talk about, true of everybody who gets, who's engaged with politics.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff you talk about, you're not an expert on, you draw on sources, and then you have to be careful.
I'm,
and I think in this case, and
exactly.
This is why I feel, in this kind of mea culpa spirit, I think it's an important one to mention, is that I think I just believed the people who I had agreed with in general about the war. And, as you remember, this was, you know, an incredibly contentious issue at the time. I think we had a conversation about these, the issues about the surge when Petraeus was testifying to Congress, and MoveOn.org had those, Petraeus betray us, and I think betray us, and I thought, and you thought, we both thought at the time that that was a really objectionable thing to say. Nevertheless, I was, I was pretty skeptical, and,
I remember too being pretty blinkered that, for example, there's this guy, I'm sure you know of him, Frederick Kagan, who's a defense intellectual at the American Enterprise Institute or some such place. And he was a big surge proponent. And I remember once just in a throwaway line, you know, saying, oh man, the neocons have come upon hard times. Mm-hmm. You know, we've fallen from Irving Kristol to Bill Kristol, and from, was it Jerome Kagan, his father at Yale, who was a noble defender of the canon, as I recall, from the culture wars of the 80s, to Frederick Kagan. You know, and I was just so dismissive. And you're right. I do think that with pretty much every, if you're saying it, pretty much everybody is saying it, that on this one, Frederick Kagan was right. And, you know, others who were advocating that. And that's kind of, it is chastening to think that you were so, that I was so dismissive of a serious person.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they were on the wrong side of the general posture toward, you know, fighting wars and, you know, going after, quote unquote bad guys in the
Middle East. Right. I mean, I think the rationale for being dismissive was, you think, look, their judgment has been wrong in the past. They're driven by, you know, kind of ideological predispositions to downplay the dangers of this job and the difficulties of it. But, you know, as is always the case, you hold up that criticism of them, and then you want to hold up the mirror to yourself and ask if you're doing the same thing.
Okay, but so we're talking about things, you know, that you got wrong. We can talk about some of the things that I got wrong. But I wanted to just stay on this point here about how you react to expertise in an ideologically charged environment in the context of Afghanistan now. Okay, so the president is deliberating, and so the strategy is being reevaluated in light of the troubling elections in Afghanistan and so forth and so on, and General McChrystal and all of that, and what do we think about that? I mean, I fear another 10 years. Into a kind of quagmire and in a very difficult military and political situation, and I kind of want us to get out. And I just wonder if I'm being a Pollyanna that.
I'm with you on the substance and with you on asking the question. I was in thinking about this. I was reminded of what happened in late 79 after the Soviet Union went into Afghanistan. I think it was December 24th, 1979. Brzezinski wrote a memo to Carter, and Brzezinski says to Carter, it was a kind of, now we've got them where we want them.
Yeah.
What he said specifically was, you know, they have just, this is going to be their Vietnam.
Yeah, I've heard this.
And,
said,
you know, and the thing is, the Mujahideen and certainly bin Laden think that what brought the Soviet Union down was not, you know, the neoconservative American foreign policy, was not the buildup during, you know, of nuclear weapons during the Reagan administration, or military forces during the Reagan administration. What brought the Soviet Union down was the war in Afghanistan. So they, so I my guess is, you know, they're thinking similarly, you know, great if there's a surge in Afghanistan, because it'll be a disaster for the United States. And what I haven't seen, and these reflections about the surge are, you know, they're important to keep in mind in thinking about this case. I'll just say that what I haven't seen is a case for this counterinsurgency strategy. And I think there are three issues there. First of all, there's the, if you think that something like the surge did some good in Iraq, then why not think it's going to do some good in Afghanistan? Well, the situation, the answer,
I thought totally, the conditions
completely
were completely
different. And that's why I think it matters why the surge had some effect. There was a functioning government in Iraq. The Sunnis, I think, really had been defeated in the civil war. There was a deep division within the Shias, and there there was a possibility for the government to move, for the Iraqi government to move in ways that had been, and there was a real exhaustion that had been produced by an intense civil war that had, by the time mid 2007, had been going on for 4 years. So I don't think the analogy holds much on the issue about, you know, there's an issue about whether this is a winnable strategy, and winning this counterinsurgency strategy really is, in the most extreme way, a case of nation and state building. I mean, you got a big place, it's a lot of rural population, a lot of, you know, tribal, you know, divisions and fighting. You have a strong insurgency, you have a horrible terrain to be fighting on, and you don't really have, you know, a history and tradition of a functioning national state. So
But here's the thing for me, quite apart from the specifics about Afghanistan, which you've been, you know, calling attention to just now, very important, but quite apart from that, I know this is by way of a confession, actually. I don't know what we're fighting for.
That's the third point. I agree
with
you. I mean,
there's this formula that people utter about making sure that Afghanistan doesn't become a sanctuary for and the base from which, you know, we can be attacked and so on. And I don't doubt that there's a threat. I'm not saying there's no threat.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know exactly what the nature or the extent of the threat is, or how contingent the threat is upon anything that happens on the ground in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, this war fighting posture where we've got everything is so abstract. The enemy is abstract here. I can't locate the enemy precisely.
Yeah.
It can't be Islamic fundamentalism. That can't be the enemy, because that war never ends, does it? So. What, you know, and how much of what might be the long-term solution to the conflict, if I could come to understand the nature of the conflict, depends upon a force of arms versus other things. And this is not just hard power, soft power. I'm not just making, you know, a simple dichotomy like that. But I wish someone would explain to me, you know, are we going to be at war for 5 years, for 15 years, or for 500 years?
Yeah, well, that's where I think the you know, there are, aside from the disanalogies with Iraq, there's this issue of, you know, whether this is a quote, winnable conflict, unquote, which is partly a question about what kind of conflict it is and what the purpose of it is. And I think there the purpose has to be understood as the purpose of the counterinsurgency strategy, and the way it's being advertised really is a very long-term occupation of this place for the purposes of building a, you know, a an Afghan nation state, which you know, is not, you know, which I find, you know, on the one hand, implausible as a strategy, but on the other, and your point, I agree with this, is, you know, if that was really necessary in order to achieve some, you know, paramount, you know, good, then, you know, you swallow hard and you do what needs to be done. But I haven't heard the, I haven't either heard the case. I mean, I think the case is something like this. Pakistan has a lot of nuclear weapons. It's, you know, there are lots of worries about those Pakistani nuclear weapons. And I think the case that some people think, you know, is the winning case is that you really can't, you don't have any hope of dealing with that issue if you're not doing something successful in Afghanistan. But so long as, you know, you can't, there's you know, Bob, our fearless leader, Robert Wright, had a blogging heads conversation the other day in which he was asking the question, announcing it as a crazy question, which is, you know, can't you just turn, what's wrong with just turning Afghanistan over to the Taliban and focusing on the Pakistan issue? Well, I would like to, you know, it is.
They're interrelated, they're so interconnected that one can't do that.
They're so interconnected that one can't do that. That was the answer. And, you know, but that's an answer that works at about 30 or 40,000 feet. The world is much more complicated than that. And, you know, whatever the strategy is going to be, it's not a strategy of saying, oh, sorry, we didn't mean to be here. We're leaving. Taliban, you know what, you know, we'll set up your quarters for you before you go, and we're going to focus on. It's a much more complicated situation than that. But the idea of going into a 10-year fight, 10 more years, we've been there 8 years already, a 10-more-year fight in Afghanistan, the purpose of which is to create a strongly functioning, you know, Afghan state out of the current situation, that doesn't seem to me like a...
Okay, let me ask you a philosopher's question,
yeah.
Josh. Here's another question. It's related, though. Women, the status of women in a society like a society run by the Taliban.
Yeah.
Okay, is that a war-making issue?
No. And the reason I think it's not a war-making issue is not to trivialize the issue. I think it's the stuff about the situation of women in under the Taliban in Afghanistan, or comparable situation in parts of Pakistan. Those are issues of incredible importance, not just to the women who are being abused, you know, hideously abused, and also because, you know, generally speaking, places that where women are treated better than that are places that don't have the kind of dysfunction that.
So there are many reasons that one would want not to have women.
That's right, and there are reasons of incredible moral importance. But, you know, going to war, there are two issues about going to war. One issue about going to war is that, you know, a lot of innocent people are going to be killed in the best war, and that's a really bad thing, and so a terrible thing, and you only do that when the purpose is of the greatest importance, and you don't have any other way of achieving the goal. You do it only when your back is against the wall. And that's what I think the idea that you're going to go in and fight a war, the success of which, in terms of improving conditions of women, is, you know, at best uncertain, and in which you know a lot of innocent people are going to die, and in which it's not obvious that all other avenues have been exhausted. So,
though it has been said, and I've always thought at the time, rightly said, that you know, were we to go into a situation like this, offer in some sense the hope of, you know, reconstructing a state or constructing a state that would be a, you know, open society and a democratic society and one that respected human rights across the board, and then pull out and then reach the judgment that well, you know, this isn't working out for us, and it's not something that we can sustain over a long period of time, mm-hmm. and as much as we would rather have it otherwise, you know, there are realities, and as long as the homeland is not, you know, being threatened by these activities, I mean, it's not our business exactly what the domestic structure of the Afghanistan. And then the counterargument will be made, but what about the fate of the women?
Right.
And so, therefore, you may stay at war, at least on the margin, because a consideration like that weighs into the political dynamic about a very difficult judgment, like the judgment that the President of the United States is
right.
making.
So, you know, again, I mean, I think the issue there is it necessary? Is it effective to have the war, to have a war to do that, to achieve that goal? Is that an effective strategy for achieving that goal? And because of the inevitable, incredible human costs of war, is there no other way of achieving that goal? And I think you only, you know, go in for the use of military force when you have any, you know, a goal of transcendent importance, when you think you have a reasonable prospect of success in achieving that goal, and you think there's no other way of advancing the goal than by doing something that inevitably produces a potentially very large-scale loss of innocent human life. I mean, I think that's the, you know, certainly that's what's happened in Iraq. I mean, tens of thousands of people end up getting killed because of the U.S. invasion. So I think each of those issues matters, the magnitude of the goal, the likelihood of an effectiveness in achieving the goal, and is there really no other way to achieve the goal? And I don't think the case has been made in Afghanistan for that. Yeah.
So good. Can I talk about one of the things I got wrong? I think I got wrong. We're holding each other accountable or holding ourselves accountable before each other. And of course, because I have been a blogging head, regular, semi-regular, you know, over these years, and people will know that I didn't support Barack Obama in the Democratic primary campaign. I supported Hillary Rodham Clinton. And when I look back, and I'm not, okay, so I was, quote, was I wrong about that, close quote? Yeah, well, obviously I was wrong in that I supported, you know, I put my money on the horse, that horse didn't win. Was I wrong about that in some more cosmic sense? Probably. I failed to appreciate and take sufficiently seriously the power of the Obama, you know, insurgency, if I can use that term, of the Obama phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I failed to fully take its measure. But then I also have to do a kind of personal inventory thing on it. You know, why didn't I believe? Why couldn't I, you know, this kind of thing? You know, I'm sort of going back because what I realize is I missed a tremendously exhilarating experience. You know, a bit like the sports fan whose team falls behind, like the Angels fell behind in that game against the Yankees last night, if you watched it. I'm rooting against the Yankees, people. And then you turn the thing off in disgust, and you miss the comeback where they win in the ninth inning or whatever it might be, you know, like that. So I deprived myself of this ride with the Obama phenomenon from beginning to end. I wouldn't invest myself in it. I wouldn't believe in it. And, you know, what does that say about your humble servant here? You know, maybe a psychoanalyst could plumb that. I'd probably just as soon not do it right here.
Well, I think there's an interesting
thing.
Well, I think there's there's an interesting question there, which maybe this is between you and your analyst, though, which is so there are a bunch of us, and I count myself in this group. I was not initially an Obama supporter. I actually was initially a supporter of, excuse my language, the scumbag John Edwards.
He did let us down, didn't he? My wife was too, and she hangs around in shame every time his name comes up.
When I became a supporter of Obama, I thought of myself as being if I can put it this way, not a "we are the ones we have been waiting for" supporter of Obama. I mean, I didn't think he was going to repeal the laws of political gravity Right. He was running to more to the center on a bunch of issues than Clinton, like on the health care issue, where he was getting beaten up for saying that he was not going to get everybody covered. And that's a promise he's delivering on. The health care plans are not going to get everybody covered. But I thought there was I thought there were good reasons for supporting Obama that didn't require, and I continue to think this, so there were good reasons for supporting him and for continuing to support him, that didn't require going in for any of the hype about him. He just seemed like, you know, a very, very smart, thoughtful, deliberative, some say dithering, but I think deliberative guy with a real deep engagement with a wide range of policy issues and thoughtful things to say about those issues, and somebody who was, even if he wasn't the one we were waiting for, he was capable of inspiring a bunch of people. And so I thought there were good reasons for supporting him. And I suppose the way to put the question back to you was, why did you think that you had to buy the hype in order to support him? You could have been a kind of, you know, best of the available candidates kind of person without thinking, you know, our savior.
Well, you're right, and I did make that separation. I guess I was a bit offended by the hype at some level, but I think also being black has something
to do with it. Yeah, I'm just guessing.
You know, because in my case, the hype was like family members coming around with T-shirts and caps from Chicago. I'm from Chicago, you know, with Obama's likeness on it. And Obama would be on one half of the T-shirt, and Martin Luther King Jr. would be on the other half. And the thing would say, you know, he had a dream and now the dream has come true. Uh-huh. And then I would throw a fit.
Right.
You know, I would just go crazy. That kind of thing made me crazy. Maybe it also made me guilty. Made me crazy intellectually because I thought that was mindless.
Right.
No offense intended to people, but I really did. I just thought that wasn't politically mature.
Right.
But then feel guilty because, you know, I mean, Bill Cosby is carrying his parents' photographs into the voting booth with him when he casts his ballot for Obama.
Yeah.
Tears are flowing in Jesse Jackson's eyes in Grant Park, Chicago, when Obama ascends to the presidency and so on. So, you know, I mean, how can you not be for that? How can you not, you know, how can you not buy that hype?
Right.
You know. So I found myself... you know, just and then there was, as I've said, a generational aspect to it. I'm a man of a certain age, as anybody looking at me can see. Got a little gray beard here. I'm in my seventh decade of life. And I just felt like, you know, stuff was moving so fast and my generation was being passed by somehow.
Right.
I mean, I really do think that was part of it. If I'm on the couch.
Yeah.
If I'm on the couch and everybody's got to see me go through I'll confess. I think I just felt like I was getting a little bit old. I think Barack Obama made me feel like I was getting old.
So the issue comes around.
Because I am getting old. I mean, I'm not old, people.
No, I know what you mean.
Every year is another year.
It wasn't. I think there was not just an age thing. There was specifically also a generational thing. That is,
a generational
thing.
People
who had a stake
thing,
in a certain way of thinking about issues about race in the United States and Obama. With
times are moving on.
Times are moving on. This is the, you know, and it's, you know, bullshit. You know, it's the post-racial thing. And there was a lot of you know, people who not only thought that that was wrong, but also I think dangerous and maybe offensive. But I think the issue comes back around now.
Yeah, I think I might agree with all three of
them.
Yeah,
no, I know. I think you probably did, and that was my sense. And the issue comes back around now, which is when we're evaluating the success or lack of success of Obama, do we evaluate him by reference to, you know, the hype? Because, you know, evaluated by reference to the hype, you know, what we have is...
He falls short, as he must have inevitably.
That's right. Both points are true. He falls short, and he must inevitably have fallen short. And so do we want to go to people who are pushing the hype and say, see, your guy is, you know, on earth just like the rest of us? Or do we want to say, you know, he's doing a pretty good job. This is what I think. He's doing a pretty good job. And it's not... You know, he doesn't live up to the hype, but what you want to do is criticize the hype, not the job. Why do I think he's doing a pretty good job? Well, I think the stimulus bill wasn't a bad thing. I think I do believe, and maybe
it was a necessary
thing politically.
It turned out to be a Christmas tree of sorts.
Absolutely, and but you know that's
that's in
the nature of the thing. Judge the thing by the right standards. Unlike Cheney, I don't see what he's doing on Afghanistan as dithering. I do think it's deliberating. Although I think I saw a comment that I want to say. Mentioned this Bill O'Reilly talking about the Cheney speech on Fox News. And, you know, there are some things about Bill O'Reilly that I really don't like. I don't like all the yelling and screaming. You know, I don't like it anymore Keith Olbermann than I like it with O'Reilly. But, you know, O'Reilly, when O'Reilly is on, I think O'Reilly is pretty good. He gave one of the best interviews of Obama during the campaign. In this set of comments about the Cheney speech, he didn't say, you know, I agree with Cheney. He didn't say I disagree with Cheney. He said, you know, Cheney's making a pretty good point. That is, Obama should jump with the McChrystal strategy or something like that, or he should decide that he's not going to do that, or he should get up and explain what the issues are that are leading him not to make a decision between a further escalation or some alternative, you know, maybe Joe Biden counterterrorism rather than counterinsurgency strategy. But the time had really come for him to.
Well, that's a point that can be made. It may not be correct, but at least it's a
totally
fair
point. And I think, Bill O'Reilly isn't always fair and balanced, but he sometimes is. And
Don't you think that this pushback that Obama is getting, both from inside the military ranks, where, you know, the Secretary of Defense and the White House National Security Advisor, himself a former general officer, have to say publicly that military officers need to give their advice up the chain of command and stop fronting the president.
Yeah.
You know, and don't you think that Dick Cheney is speaking for people? Yeah. I mean, I don't know anything about this shadowy world of defense contractors and former members of Congress and military officers, but I know it exists. Yeah. You know, there's an establishment out there, and they may not like what the president, he's an African-American, and his name is Barack Hussein Obama, but that's probably not the most important thing. Left of center, a president who's been going around on the world stage apologizing for America's, arrogance and miscues, and they may not like what he's doing. And while I'm not predicting a coup d'etat in these United States of America, I'm not. Still, I'm made to sit on the edge of my chair and to feel a little tingle up my spine when I hear people talking in public like that.
Talking in public like Cheney did.
Yeah, he basically called the president unfit to lead the military. Yeah. He didn't say it in quite those words, but he said he's dithering while our men are dying and women in battle.
Well,
and that kind of talk, I mean, okay, it may come up here, it may come up there, but you don't want that to be the norm, I don't think.
No, you don't want that to be the norm, but this is unsettling to me. It's at points like this that I think we need to hold up the mirror to ourselves as well. And by ourselves, I mean us and people who are broadly on our side of these issues. We go back to that betray us, betray us. That what I thought was really disgraceful.
Yes.
I mean, I've given money to MoveOn.org over the years, and I've continued to do it sometimes, but I thought that was really awful. There was plenty of stuff said about the ability of George Bush to lead I happen to agree with it in that case, but it was just it wasn't playing to a world of former defense officials and military officers. But there were plenty of people saying George Bush was incapable of leading, that he was a moron, a warmonger, and whether that's true or not, and I think there is a need for accountability on Iraq and on torture. Nevertheless, I think the criticisms were comparable. I think that's politics. It's democratic politics. People make sharp criticisms, and I think this is of a piece with these issues about Fox News. their work.
Yeah, let's talk about that. But let me just say one thing on that, though, Josh, because I don't want to be misunderstood. I wasn't saying don't criticize Obama. I criticize him myself, and, you know, have at him. I was saying I'm unsettled by a tone that I'm detecting in the criticism and some of the source of the criticism and fear that the thing might go really quite high and quite deep in the power establishment of the United States of America. And I just want to watch it. I want to keep my eye on it.
On that, I completely agree with you. It's not, and I think the, you know, I think there's the tone of the criticism, you know, is sometimes disturbing. I think, you know, on the other hand, I think maybe to be a little bit too fair and balanced here, you know, I think the tone of some of the pushback is disturbing. I think there's been a lot of
So let's hear about that. You don't like what the White House has been saying about taking on Fox News?
I mean, I think this is just a, you know, you know, I find, you know, Glenn Beck I find unbearable. Sean Hannity I mostly find unbearable. I mean, I find it hard to watch him, although occasionally I think, you know, he's a sharp guy and he's interesting. He's a Reagan Republican. It helps to hear somebody who's a kind of, you know, Reagan Republican, as is, you know, Sarah Palin. And it has a certain kind of meaning, and it helps to hear what I find it helpful to hear what he has to say. I said, as I said, I think Bill O'Reilly is okay. But, you know, let me put it to you this way. If you're sitting at Fox News right now, you know, you're Roger Ailes or Rick, you're sitting at Fox News right now and you're hearing this pushback against what you're up to, are you celebrating or are you worried? You know, they can say, you're celebrating.
You're not worried.
Not worried at all.
The First Amendment to protect.
Yeah, I mean, they pretend that they're worried. They say, oh, you know, first it's going to be us and then, it's, you know, then they're going to shut down the media. This is a complete horseshit. But I don't think they're worried at all, but they're celebrating. They're celebrating because they are doing the classic thing that an adolescent does. The adolescent, you know, nags and is a pain in the ass and irritates until finally the adolescent gets, is sufficiently provocative to get a reaction, and then the adolescent feels really good. And I think that's what these people at Fox News are doing, and I think these complaints that are coming out of the administration about what Fox News is up to are basically like the classic mistake of the adult who gives into the provocations of the kid. They should.
Okay, but there's another point here, Josh, that I want to see how you react to, and that is the White House has had an incredibly, in the Barack Obama campaign prior to the coming into the White House, an incredibly favorable press on the whole.
Yes,
a fawning press. An uncritical press at many different points and junctures. And therefore, there's something that I find, hypocritical or maybe, let me just try to temper my remarks. Especially in light of what I was saying just a moment ago.
Yeah.
But I do find it a little bit precious that people will come out on the lawn out in front of the White House and go to the press room and they will start complaining about how this or that was said about them that was not fair, when I think I could probably with some effort find a dozen or more instances where this or that might have been quite fairly said about them but wasn't said by anybody because they're all rooting for them.
I agree with you. I think it's unfortunate when it's there are people who are there are plenty of people, I think, who are critical without doing the without being absurd. I mean, Glenn Beck is a sort of an absurd circus performer, a rodeo show guy, who's, as he's more or less said himself, with his Vicks Vapor Rub, crying on TV.
Yeah, okay, let me give you one issue. One issue. I know you're probably going to say something, but just one issue. Are illegal immigrants going to end up being benefited in terms of the availability of health care by the legislation that's being considered? Okay? Now, here's what I want to say about that. I think the answer is probably yes.
Uh-huh.
When everything is worked out. Not that that's in the legislation or that somebody's trying to do that. Okay? And I think it's a good thing, too.
Yeah, me too.
Okay? Because the basic motivation for this is the human rights of people. Okay? To be able to have access to health care when they're sick in a decent society. Okay? Not some people with certain kind of marks on the pieces of paper that they carry in their back pocket, but human beings generally. So I say yes, and it's a good thing, too. Now, if somebody says, Your legislation has this property, and they're trying to, the property being that illegal immigrants are going to benefit. And they're trying to make a political point to stop your legislation. Of course, out of survival instinct, you have to say, particularly since it's true as a matter of the letter of the legislation, no, it doesn't. But of course, there should be a healthy public debate, shouldn't there, both about, well, if you enact a kind of entitlement of this sort, and if you realize enforcement is imperfect, certain consequences will ensue. That's a perfectly legitimate thing to discuss.
Absolutely.
And secondly, besides, I thought the motivation here was that people had a right to something, and while you may not like it, those are people too. The ones over there without papers, they're people. So rather than to manage that conversation, I guess what I'm trying to say is let there be a Fox News trying to make a partial point about this, because the overall discussion is interesting, and it's better than trying to whitewash it and shut it up and put a lid on it so that we don't talk about it at all.
I agree with that completely. I agree with the substance of what you said, that there probably will be some people who are in the country illegally who end up getting covered. First, second, I think that that's a good thing for the reasons that you gave. Third, I think that is not, because of the state of political discourse, the people who are raising that are people who think it's a bad thing that you get the coverage, and I think that's unfortunate. I think it's
more unfortunate can be confident that a substantial plurality will think that it's a
that's bad right, thing. And I think it would be important for people who are on the other side of the issue to be raising that and then forthrightly defending it in just the way that I think the analogous case, and I'm going to last point here, and then I really do have to run. Take the Acorn thing. I think it's I think Acorn generally has been a pretty good organization. They've done a lot of stuff.
I have a colleague here at Brown, a political scientist named Marion Orr, who writes books about community organizing. And he was going on and on and on about how good a thing he thought they were on the whole, not trying to defend any specific
disgraceful behavior, disgraceful, disgusting behavior by some of the people in those offices, and all the more disgraceful and disgusting because Acorn has been, on the whole and for the most part, a good organization in terms of bringing people into politics, and also a good organization in terms of, getting services for people. So, really terribly unfortunate. Now, I think it's, awful. This is one of the stories that, critics of the mainstream media are right about. The mainstream media missed the Acorn story, and the reason that the downside of the Acorn story, and whether it's a little downside or a big downside, I think remains an open issue. But they missed the downside of the Acorn story because they were so concerned not to raise any questions in an environment in which the organization was under attack that they let it. They let the only people raising those questions be people who wanted to destroy Acorn. So I think, this brings us back to our topic at the, our opening up at the top of the hour. I think a little bit more kind of self-critical attitude, a little more holding up the mirror to ourselves on part of people who are, on our side wouldn't be such a bad thing. Instead of going.
So have you read any, Pierre Bourdieu? The French sociologist, he has this concept of reflexivity that he applies to sociological analysis that I think for the scholar, for the theorist of society is also a admonition of that sort.
That's right.
Let the mirror reflect back on oneself in an analytical sense. But maybe that's for another conversation. Anyway, nice
talking
to you, Josh.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take good care of yourself.